Ready. Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Senate Committee on Healthcare. It is Monday, March 2nd, and I would like to open a work session on introduction of committee bills.
Madam Chair, I move the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC 3943, dated 2/26/15, and LC 4028, dated 2/27/15.
Senator Cruz moves that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC 3943, dated 2/26/15, and LC 4028, dated 2/27/15. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered. I will now open a work session on Senate Bill 72.
Madam Chair, I move the dash one amendment to Senate Bill.
Well, wait. Okay.
You want her to explain
Zena,
first?
Zena, will you explain the amendment? Sorry.
Probably a good idea.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 72 directs the Oregon State Board of Nursing to impose an additional $9 for examination fees and license renewal fees charged for a registered nurse or licensed practical nurse. It creates a nursing advancement fund to credit additional fees imposed. There is a dash one amendment which clarifies that the fund is referring to the Oregon State Board of Nursing Fund.
Okay.
Now, okay, Madam Chair, I move the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 72.
Senator Cruz moves the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 72. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So adopted.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 72 as amended by the dash one amendment to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Finance and Revenue be rescinded, and that the bill be re-referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay. Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 72 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that a subsequent referral to Committee on Finance and Revenue be rescinded, and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll. Excused.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator Steiner Hayward?
Excused.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chair Colleen Anderson?
Aye. And the bill is on its way. I will close the work session on Senate Bill 72 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 505. Zena.
Madam Chair and committee members, Senate Bill 505 requires that from October 1st through March 1st, each hospital in the state should offer immunizations against influenza viruses to patients 65 years and up. There's no revenue impact, and it may have a fiscal impact, but the statement hasn't been issued yet.
Okay. Sean.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Sean Miller, I'm here today on behalf of Sanofi Pasteur, which is the vaccines division of Sanofi. So Sanofi is the largest company in the world devoted entirely to vaccines, and its vision is a world in which no one suffers or dies from a vaccine-preventable disease. The bill before you today is a bill that's been passed in several states. Simply requires from October 1 through March 1 flu season of each year, each hospital in the state must offer the influenza virus to patients 65 years and older. It's been recognized for many years that people 65 years and older have a greater risk of serious complications from the flu compared with young, healthy adults. During most seasons, it's estimated that 90% of the seasonal flu-related deaths and between 50 and 60% of the seasonal flu-related hospitalizations in the United States occur in people 65 years and older. Again, this is because human immune defense becomes weaker with age, and so this influenza is a very serious disease for people 65 years and older. The bill, again, deals with just the flu season. shows that the studies can be 70% more effective in preventing hospitalizations for influenza of these persons over 65 years of age. And so, again, you know, I think, you know, we're not at all criticizing the hospitals of not doing a good job of this. I think we're just trying to standardize this this operation, basically process. So again, if you look at the bottom of my testimony, just looks at the states that have approved this legislation and it passed in regulation in one state. And so we're asking for support of the committee and happy to answer any questions.
Good questions? Thank you. Ms. O'Sullivan.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Patricia O'Sullivan. I'm representing the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. And, you know, we're really perplexed what our position on this bill is. Mr. Miller is right. About 40 to 60% of patients that come in and have to be hospitalized inpatient for flu issues are seniors. And in fact, our hospitals all already do offer everybody in the hospital as an inpatient a flu shot. So not just folks over 65, but everybody. And it's actually part of our accountability to CMS for flu immunization data, and also part of our hospital inpatient quality reporting program for the feds. And from that, it's an indicator of a value-based purchasing program, which actually gives financial incentives for meeting certain criteria. So we report it to the feds. The indicators are that if you do it at a high rate, you save money on value-based purchasing. We know it's good. It saves lives. So we can't say it's not a good bill. We already do it, so we don't see the purpose for the bill. And furthermore, just to, you know, for the last two sessions, I fought really hard to get mandated flu immunizations for healthcare workers in our hospitals and have lost every session to make it mandatory. So it seems a little bit of a kind of a contradiction to now say that these poor old people have to get, you know, immunization shots for the flu, which we already do, but what is it to protect them against our healthcare workers in the hospitals? Because they're not mandated to get flu shots. So it just seems a little strange to me.
Well, the main difference is there's informed consent. And, you know, but you're right on.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Thank you. My apologies for being late. Do we have data on, Ms. O'Sullivan or Mr. Miller, do we have data on exactly what percentage of people who go into hospitals now are already immunized against influenza, and of the portion that are unimmunized, how many come out having been immunized? I mean, I guess I'd like to know what problem we're trying to solve, in essence, which I think is sort of what Ms. O'Sullivan is asking in a different kind of way. And if we had data that said that, you know, 80% of people over 65 weren't being immunized against influenza, and they go into the hospital and it still doesn't happen, I'd agree with you. I think this would be very important to do. I guess I'm not convinced that that's what's actually happening yet, and so I'd just like to know, believe me, as everybody in this room knows, I'm a huge fan of immunizations, but I guess I'd like to know what the data are that support the need for this legislation.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Steiner Harewood, I will try to get some data. I know that there's the only requirement now, or the only, you know, again, Ms. Sullivan's right, that they're only based on how they record and the financial incentives on their rates from the federal government. So there's nothing in law that says that they have to offer. Now they are offering.
Oh, I understand that.
Yeah, and so again, I don't know from each hospital. I think each hospital is going to be different, and so all we're trying to do is standardize it, a lot making mandating that they offer the virus.
Thank you. I get that. I guess I would say that those data should be pretty easy to pull. Mm-hmm. I mean, at any hospital that has an electronic health record, all you have to do is run a report mm-hmm. on people over 65 and see what percentage have been immunized
yeah.
Against influenza, either before they came in, which should be recorded in their record even if they didn't get it there, or while they're in the hospital. And I, you know, as much as I believe everybody should get an influenza shot, I certainly push my colleagues enough, both here and in other settings, to do it. I don't necessarily think that adding another mandate to the hospitals right now is the right thing to do, unless we have the data to support that it's necessary.
Senator Cruz?
I'd be interested, based on that one, when I went in, excuse me, for hip replacement, I was asked if I wanted influenza shot, and I'd already had one, so I said I'd already had one. I mean, is the fact that I declined because I already had it, would that be in the record? I mean,
generally speaking, yes, because then they'd probably pull your information from the immunization alert service, and or they would just document that you'd had it in the record, because we do. Most hospitals, I think, document it. You could go back and ask your doctor.
Chairman Sanderson, Senator Cruz, I believe it is, because they're also asking right now if you've been out of the country in the last 2 weeks, every time you go to the doctor's office or step in a hospital, or and all those things that they ask are documented typically. Yeah. It would be a little harder to get it all out of the system than it sounded, but I'm sure it's in there. Somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, my reason for asking, because I didn't go to my doctor. I just went to the pharmacy and got a flu mm-hmm. shot. And
right.
And so I'm not quite sure how all of this at this point in time tracks together. And so, you know.
But based on the CMS requirement about reporting, I would be 99% sure that they would be documenting that somewhere in your chart, so that when they have to do their reporting to CMS, they would say, no, we didn't give Mr. Cruz his flu shot, but that's because he said he already had one.
I think so.
I mean, you know, I mean, because otherwise we're getting some false indicators of, you know, not getting a shot in the hospital because they got it someplace else, and if there's a way to have that backed up to make sure that there is coverage there, sort of thing.
Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Cruz, this bill would not do anything to help that.
I understand that.
Okay.
And this bill, by the way, doesn't mandate anything except an offer, which is already being done. So,
thank you very much. Is
Thanks.
There any I think there's no one else to testify on this bill, correct? All right. I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 505 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 564. Zena?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 564 requires that personally identifiable information in the statewide cancer and benign tumor registry may not be reported to the Oregon Health Authority, requires the Oregon Health Authority to adopt rules and remove personally identifiable information. There is no revenue impact, and there may be a fiscal impact, but the statement hasn't yet been issued.
Okay. Cheryl Bowman, please come forward. Colleagues, this bill came to us because Cheryl requested it. And as most of us know, we like to have constituents have the opportunity to introduce legislation that they feel is necessary. So welcome, Cheryl. Please introduce yourself and tell us why you brought this bill forward.
Hi, I'm Cheryl Bowman, and I want to thank Jeff Cruz and also Lori Monisa Sanderson for supporting this. I guess you guys have not read what I submitted already. Is that true?
Some of us have, some of us haven't. So.
Okay, so go ahead and just read what I wrote.
Sure.
Okay. In November 2009, I was diagnosed with cancer, had surgery December 4th, started chemo in January, and went through April 2010. Before finishing the chemo, I started getting phone calls from Providence, and I can't remember the dialogue in most of those, but I do remember one time I said, if I get this cancer back, and she said, oh, you will. I said, excuse me? And she said, you will. And what kind of a thing is that to say to somebody that had major surgery? I got down to 78 pounds and then go through months of chemo and have somebody tell me I'm going to get it back. I just could not believe my ears, and I told her to never call me again. So then the state of Oregon, I got a letter from them saying, hey, we know about your cancer. What do you want to do about it? And I said, do not contact, and sent it back. In December of 2013, right before Christmas, of all times, to remind a cancer patient that they've had cancer, that's the last time you want to think about it, I received a letter from the state of Oregon wanting me to get genetic testing and also do an online survey. So I called them and I said, how many people did you send this to? And it was something around, somewhere around 3,000. And I says, how can you do that to cancer patients right before Christmas? It's not ethical. And I said, I want to be removed from the list. She transferred me over to Jeff Soule, and he maintained the registry, and he refused to take me off. The only person I feel that should contact a cancer patient is their own doctor. The reason for that is their doctor is the only one that knows where they're at physically and mentally in the process. It's a lot to go through. So at that point, I wanted to find out, get to the bottom of what was going on. So then I called Providence. They sent me all over the hospital. Nobody tell me who was collecting my information. I was trying to figure out what happened through all this process. Well, evidently, I finally found, accidentally stumbled across cancer, Providence Cancer, in the phone book. And I called them, and I asked her what was going on. And she says, yes, we are collecting your information. So I sent a do not, you know, basically to who it may concern letter to my doctor's office and also to Providence, stating that my information was personal and that you should ask for my written consent. And that I called my doctor's office, and they said they were required to provide that. And they sent a questionnaire to my doctors every year, Providence does, and I asked for a copy of it. And if you see it in the materials that I submitted, how would you feel if you saw this? They want to know if you're alive or dead, what your cause of death is, where you died, any reoccurrences. Doctors can report things as reoccurrences without giving personal identification. They don't need to be saying, this person, they take your name, your address, your social security number, your date of birth, and it's out there, you know, and they can hand it on to other people. And I have no idea who all has my information. Death records are out there, and they always have cause of death. They can tell from those. And the purpose of the registry, supposedly, is to identify clusters of cancer. What you need for that is a zip code and the type of cancer and a report. But you could have age without the date of birth, and you could have sex. That I don't have a problem with, or the medical records. But when you personally identify it to an individual, and then they are bothered by phone calls, letters, whatever, even though I told them not to call me. Double counting isn't an issue. That's what they use, and it's an excuse to take these personal identifiers. A doctor, any doctor that you go to, will know whether you had a reoccurrence or not and can report it as a reoccurrence without giving a person's name and all the personal information. And I kept digging, and I found out Providence was giving it to the state. The state is giving it to the CDC. The CDC is funding this, and they have circumvented HIPAA laws so that cancer patients have no privacy. I got this disease through no fault of my own, and yet it's not contagious, and yet I feel like I'm a victim of this. I think there needs to be honesty and integrity. What I'd like to see is the hospital registries to provide somebody with a consent form where they can consent to this information being out there or not, and without tying it to services or, you know, insurance companies paying the bills. And then give a type and a zip code of any cancer, have doctors report reoccurrences. And I'd like this to even, this is a great start. I'd like it to include facilities too, these hospital registries.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for Ms. Bowman?
Thank you very much. And we have a number, I told you, a number of people that are going to explain to us why cancer registries are needed.
Well, I understand that they're needed, but they aren't needed to this extent where they're personally pointing at cancer patients. It's very hurtful to a cancer patient going through all of this to find out that all their information is no longer theirs. It's a violation of the person.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, Ms. Bowman. Let's have the Oregon Health Authority, Karen Gerard. And might as well bring up Lori Schulman and Jessica Adamson.
Good afternoon, Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee. I'm Karen Gerard, the Health Promotion and Chronic Disease Prevention Section Manager for the Oregon Health Authority. I'm here today to present information related to Senate Bill 564, which would eliminate the reporting of personally identifiable information to the Oregon Cancer Reporting System established under ORS 432-510. Cancer is the leading cause of death in Oregon. The more we understand about cancer and how to treat it, the better able we are to improve patient outcomes. The Oregon State Cancer Registry is the most complete and meaningful data source available to monitor cancer incidence, treatment, and mortality. The integrity of the data hinges on protecting personal information. The registry adheres to security and confidentiality practices for data collection, storage, and reporting as required by state and federal law. This confidentiality practice is integral to maintaining quality standards for the statewide registry. The registry's mission is to provide accurate data on cancer in Oregon for cancer control activities, public health policy making, and epidemiological research. Having a statewide registry is the best way to learn more about cancer and its progression, to be able to determine possible environmental or occupational causes of cancer, and to evaluate cancer within a state, community, or population. Data from the registry also confirm the effectiveness of screening tests used to identify cancers early and whether prevention efforts are working. For example, data show that high rates of breast cancer screening is finding 4 of 5 cancers at early stages. Late-stage colorectal cancers are dropping as screening rates increase, and lung cancer rates are dropping due to tobacco prevention efforts. The registry was established by the 1995 Oregon Legislature, which made cancer a mandatory reportable disease for the purposes of conducting statewide cancer surveillance. Each year, the registry receives more than 60,000 cancer reports that, when consolidated, result in 24,000 individual case records. Cancer data are reported from multiple providers for each individual case record. Reporting entities include healthcare providers, hospitals, treatment facilities, and pathology labs. The registry consolidates these reports into one comprehensive case record, including all diagnostic and treatment data. Senate Bill 564 directly affects the ability of the registry to maintain a statewide cancer data system. The registry has continuously met national standards for quality cancer data since 1996. As a state cancer registry created under a mandatory cancer reporting system, the registry is uniquely positioned to collect, monitor, and analyze cancer data from diagnosis through end of life for all reportable cancers. Eliminating the requirement to report personally identifiable information to the registry would result in a failure to comply with national standards established by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's National Program of Cancer Registries and would likely result in a loss of this federal funding from the Centers for Disease Control, which is the only source of funding for Oregon's Cancer Registry. It would also result in a diminished ability to perform state cancer registry functions as defined under ORS 432-510, including targeting populations in need of cancer screening, supporting hospital registries and monitoring outcomes of cancer treatment, and evaluating policies addressing cancer prevention, screening, treatment, and survivorship. Cancer accounts for more than 20 deaths in Oregon each day. Oregon's Gold Standard Registry relies on rigorous compliance with all confidentiality practices because without personally identifiable cancer information, the integrity of registry data would be compromised. Data from the registry are used to monitor cancer incidence, treatment, and mortality to achieve better health, better care, and lower costs, resulting in increased cancer survivorship and improved quality of life for all Oregonians. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and I'm available to answer questions about operations of the Oregon State Cancer Registry.
So you're saying that you need Social Security number, you need a name, birth date, all of that, so that you will have an unduplicated count. Is that what you're saying?
Chair Monis Anderson, that is correct. Patient names and other personal identifiers are required to be collected and are used to consolidate cancer records into one complete case record.
And how do we know that it really is, you are really following HIPAA confidentiality? I mean, what do you do to make sure that this information isn't public?
Chair Monis Anderson, we take confidentiality of these data very seriously because without maintaining the integrity of the registry, it couldn't exist. We have complied with federal and state laws for the almost 20 years the cancer registry has been in existence, and have not had a breach of confidentiality to this date.
Stay there while we have the other two testify, and then I'll ask general questions. Any other questions for OHA? Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson here to testify on behalf of Providence Health and Services. Next to me is Lori Skokin, who will speak more to the specifics of how we gather data, why we do that, and the privacy protections in place, the requirements that we have under state law as well as national accreditation to do so. But I wanted to start by first offering a heartfelt apology to Ms. Bowman. It is our goal and effort at Providence, and certainly anybody in our cancer program, to provide very high quality and compassionate care. If there's any interaction that has caused her to feel anything but supported and cared for in that process, I want to put on the record our sincere concern and apology for that. We look forward to talking with her after the hearing's over. And again, we just, high quality care for our cancer patients is certainly, and all patients, a high and important goal for us. So Ms. Skokin can talk more about what we do as Providence.
Good afternoon. Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Lori Skokin, and I'm the Director of Clinical Performance at the Providence Cancer Center. Thank you for the opportunity to share Providence's concerns about SB 564. The Providence Cancer Center provides patients and families some of the finest, most comprehensive cancer services in the world, including state-of-the-art treatments, nationally renowned research, and compassionate counseling and support. The Robert W. Franz Cancer Research Center within the Providence Cancer Center is one of only a few research centers in the country focusing exclusively on immunotherapy. Our doctors, researchers, and other members of the care team focus on providing excellent and compassionate care while continuing the search for a cure for cancer. Providence takes its commitment to patient privacy very seriously. We provide information to cancer registries only as required by state law and accreditation requirements, and we only do so in accordance with HIPAA requirements. State law requires the reporting to the Oregon State Cancer Registry, OSCR, by hospitals, labs, and independent practitioners. We comply with the statute by uploading files to the state server per the specifications provided to us. Providence generally reports cancer cases to the state 2 to 4 times a month because of the volume of patients we serve. Providence Cancer Center is accredited by the Commission on Cancer, the COC, a program of the American College of Surgeons, which recognizes cancer care centers for their commitment to providing comprehensive, high-quality, and multidisciplinary patient-centered care in the community. In addition to providing information to OSCR, we also provide data to the National Cancer Database, the NCDB. Any facility accredited by the Commission on Cancer is required to submit these data on an annual basis. Providence, like the other accredited hospitals, has a fully executed business associates agreement as required under HIPAA with the Commission on Cancer to provide the data. In addition to reporting information about new cases to the state and to the NCDB, we are required to follow those cases on an annual basis to determine whether a patient is alive and, if so, has evidence of their cancer. The information gathered is added into the cancer registry and provided to the state and to NCDB. The Commission on Cancer Accreditation mandates that we have current follow-up on 90% of the patients diagnosed within the past 5 years and on 80% of the patients who are in your registry. Our particular one dates back to the year 2000. In order to reduce the burden on patients, we attempt to acquire this information directly from the patient's physicians or through access to the electronic medical record. If information is not available from any other source, it is possible that patients will receive a letter from the hospital of record asking about their current cancer status. Most of these patient letters do differ from the ones that are sent to the physicians. Providence abstracts and enters into our cancer registry about 5,000 new cancer cases each year, and we currently follow about 50,000 patients in our registry. Each year, we get 1 to 2 inquiries from a patient about why their information is being shared with state and national databases. Of those inquiries, the vast majority of patients are happy to help provide information that will help lead to a cure for cancer. We take seriously those patients who have concerns and share with them the information we have shared with you today. Senate Bill 564 will reduce the efficacy of the cancer registry, something we cannot afford as we search for the cure for cancer. In effect, it would only allow us to do half our job. We could measure incidence and assess that in the state, but it doesn't allow us to do death rates, to measure death rates, to see how Oregon compares to other states, to see within our own population if we have geographic or racial disparities. Current reporting mechanisms maintain the patient's right to privacy while ensuring that world-class research centers have access to the information we need to make improvements in patient care. Thank you for the opportunity to share more about our reporting processes and our concerns with SB 564. I'm happy to answer any further questions.
Good. Dan, you mentioned right to privacy, yet if you have somebody that doesn't want to be contacted, you're still contacting them. So where's their right to privacy?
Senator Cruz, no, we do not contact them personally. We may the first time. We may send them a letter if we're unable to get their information from any other source. But if they indicate that they do not want to be contacted, they're marked as do not contact in our registry. And as a state, as a hospital facility, we will not contact them any further.
Okay. Madam Chair, I guess as I've been thinking about this and, you know, when I had prostate cancer, had my cancer removed, and I was at OHSU, and I said, whatever you need, you know, which I think is the way most people probably react, which is fine. I guess I'm wondering for those individuals who don't want to play the game, if there's an opt-out for them, how bad does that skew your data? If it's like 1 or 2%, you know, sort of thing, because I think most people probably don't mind, and I guess I understand the need for the data. I guess I'm just trying to give those people who just don't want to deal with it an opt out without messing up the system, because you can still have the aggregate data, just not the personal identifier.
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, we on our own, as part of our own policies and procedures, if someone says we don't want to be contacted, we take them out of the contact list. So we will not contact them directly. If they don't want to be contacted, be part of that, that's something that we note in our registry. The state will probably speak to how the state handles that.
I guess my question, Madam Chair, would be, so you do that, do you inform everybody else that's getting the data that this is a no-contact person? That would probably be the issue, I think, at this point, because you say you aren't going to do it, but then...
Go ahead.
Senator Cruz, that's a very good question. You know, when we submit cancer to the state registry or to the National Cancer Database, we're not necessarily sure what they do on their end. Both of those databases are used for research. However, in order to release that data, a researcher has to have an IRB or Ethics Board approved research project. And most of those projects will come with de-identified data. You would have to make a very strong case. You know, really what they're looking at is the retrospective epidemiological data. Mm-hmm. They don't want to collect quality of life or that kind of information. So virtually no chance of contacting those patients.
Just add a comment about that, Madam Chair. I actually did a research project. I was one of those researchers who worked with the Cancer Registry on this. And I can assure you that not only did I have to go through OHSU's IRB, I had to go through the state's IRB, Institutional Review Board, that's a human subjects protection, and I had to really justify why the only way I could do this study was to access cancer registry data. And then, because it was something where we did want information from patients, it had to be sent out through the cancer registry, not directly from us. So it wasn't like we got that information from people about their addresses or anything like that. We just got... that we said, okay, here are the characteristics of the patients we want to understand better what's going on with them, and we gave them the letter that they'd approved to send out. They sent it out to patients who'd agreed to be contacted directly by researchers, and they also sent it to doctors for patients who said, I only want to be contacted through my doctor, and, you know, and then it went from there. So I have to say that the protections are pretty darn rigorous from the research perspective, if you want to have any, get any kind of new information from a patient.
I think my concern in this case is that you have cancer, you're very emotionally stressed at the diagnosis, and then the treatment is very stressful. And somehow, is there a way to change the process to make it less onerous to get this form that says, are you alive? You know, I mean...
They don't get the form.
The patients...
she did. We have a copy of it, I think.
I believe, Senator and Chair, I believe that she received that from her physician, and so it was not sent to her directly by the registry. As I alluded to, the physicians get a somewhat more detailed letter than we would send a patient. And of our 50,000, I can speak for Providence, of our 50,000 patients that we follow annually, we send out about 1,000 letters to patients in the course of a year, and the majority of those are returned. They are only sent to patients, as I said, if the physician is not available or there's no other record of them with any of the health systems in our area.
Thank you. Well, I'd appreciate you talking with Ms. Bowman at
we'll
after
be happy
the
to.
Hearing. Okay. Thank you very much. Ted Williamson, and then as he's coming up, I want to read from the American Cancer Society Action Network. It basically says, we are a nonprofit, nonpartisan affiliate of the American Cancer Society, and we support evidence-based policy and legislative solutions designed to eliminate cancer as a major health problem. Senate Bill 564 would have a detrimental consequence to the credibility and future use of the registry. The registry's mission is to provide accurate data, and then talks about the confidentiality. And paper. They go on to say paper documents are kept in a restricted area and locked files and are shredded as soon as they are processed. So they also did say that the registry is maintained under strict confidentiality standards and procedures and is only released in compliance with HIPAA, the Health Insurance Portability Accountability Act, and other laws. Put that in the record.
Good afternoon. My name is Ted Williamson. I am a physician, radiation oncologist on the staff at Salem Hospital, Willamette, and also Willamette Valley Medical Center. I've been here in Salem for 37 years now. In addition, I have been a member of the Oregon State Cancer Registry Advisory Board, which is not an IRB, but very similar in responsibility, for really since the inception nearly 20 years ago. I'm also co-chair of the IRB at Salem. And for the last 3 or 4 years, I've had the title of Medical Director of the Oregon State Cancer Registry. And I would like to say that the responsibilities and the compensation are compatible. There's really not much a lot of responsibility and certainly no compensation. But like Senator Cruz and like our first witness, I too have received the letter from the state a few years ago. I took a different twist on it because the intent of the letter is first of courtesy to notify the patient and secondly to give them the opportunity to participate in possible future research, to make themselves available if they wish, because we have things particularly coming from OHSU where sometimes direct patient involvement is important. Some of these things I think are already having a major impact on patient outcomes. I've got data to support that. And that's the main purpose of the letter. If the patient declines, we're not supposed to contact them further. The net effect of this bill, I sent you all an email, and unfortunately kind of late this weekend, Friday, the patients didn't allow me to do what I'd planned. And actually were a very good illustration of the problem. I saw two new patients on Friday, both seen at another hospital that will independently report the patient. So our major role, as stated in the statute, which is really to create an instance registry, find out how much, how many, where, that role would be completely destroyed because of the inability to resolve all of these duplicate registrations. That is absolutely critical. As far as the confidential information, I can speak from my experience on the advisory board. There are a number of us on that panel. And we are extremely protective, as is of the staff. There's almost no circumstance where direct patient identifying information goes out, and none where it goes out without the patient's permission. The sole purpose normally is simply to reconcile those duplicate records and truly produce an incident registry so we can look at variations within the state, different age populations, and so forth. If this bill were to pass, we really effectively would not have a cancer registry. We would be the only state in the United States in that situation. This has happened one time before in New Orleans a number of years ago. It lasted for about 2 years. They lost their funding. Eventually, it got restored when they changed the regulation. The state registry is funded almost entirely federally through the Centers for Disease Control, and it's a requirement that this collection of this data is a requirement that they place in order to keep that funding going. The rest of the information I think that might be relevant is in that letter. I won't take your, or that email rather, I won't take your time, but I'm certainly happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for coming. Thank you for sharing. Someone who's actually working in the trenches, so to speak. Any questions? All right, thank you very much. Any other further comments? Okay, I will talk to you later, Ms. Bowman, and with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 564 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 146.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 146 modifies the definition of small employers to allow those headquartered within the state to qualify as small employers.
Is this ready?
No. There's no revenue impact, and there may be a fiscal impact, but the statement hasn't been issued.
Tom Holt and Doug Barber.
This is an easy one.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tom Holt with Cambia Health Solutions here today in support of Senate Bill 146, which is a very technical correction to update our small group insurance law in terms of who can purchase small group coverage. Today and since the early 1990s, a requirement has been that a majority of the employees be located here in Oregon. As we reviewed things that would be affected by the expansion of the small group definition up to 100 employees, what we found is that there are a number of Oregon employers who would be adversely affected because since the early 1990s, we have something called the web that allows people to work remotely, and there are a lot of companies that have people scattered hither and yon, but they are headquartered here and have some of their employees here. And they would be left with the change sort of in a no man's land, even though they've done the right thing by providing benefits, health benefits to their employees for years. They would be defined as small employers, but not eligible to purchase small group insurance. So what this bill does, very simply, is add as an option, if they don't have, they can either be have a majority of their employees located here in Oregon, which is the current law, or if they're headquartered here, that's good enough. We've looked at this also from an actuarial perspective to make sure we weren't doing something unintentional to the risk pools. Our actuaries don't believe there would have any effect. It would be beneficial to employers who just want to have all their people under coverage and continue to do so after they get defined to be small employers. As far as we know, there's no opposition to this bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay.
Chairman Sanderson, members of the committee, Doug Barber here today on behalf of the Oregon Association of Health Underwriters in support of the bill. As Tom said, the nature of business is changing. Where employees are located is shifting. They no longer have to be at the headquarter office. And our members have also come forward and said, we know of businesses that would be affected by this. They're headquartered here. They have, you know, many of their employees here, but they've got folks scattered all over the country, and they may be salespeople, they may be programmers, they can be all sorts of folks. But we think that this is a logical modification of the bill with no downside.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry if I could add one thing, and it's in the materials for the bill. We did do a thorough search of the state archives to try and find out why this provision exists. We couldn't find an answer to that. There's nothing in the hearing record from that time period of why this provision was adopted in the first place.
Thank you very much. Can I have a work session on this? No? Okay. With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 146 and open a public hearing on SJM4.
SJM4 urges Congress to pass legislation that would better align with the Federal Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act by allowing healthcare providers to share patients' treatment information while maintaining protections against disclosure and discrimination.
All right.
Hi, I moved seats. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Elizabeth Steiner Hayward, State Senator from Senate District 17. As members of the committee will remember, in the 2013 session, we had the privilege of passing out of this committee Senate Bill 450, which was targeted at putting together a task force to streamline the delivery of human services. You have already heard some of the reports of the progress of that task force. We have actually submitted a separate report detailing the entire work of the task force. But suffice it to say that it was a diverse and productive group. We identified several major barriers to streamlining delivery of human services, but one of the ones that came up frequently was information sharing, not in the sense of invading people's privacies, as we have talked about already today, but in the sense that many of Oregonians who need support services often need more than one. And we face barriers because we are not allowed to share information about certain situations in ways that would actually help people and help them get the services that they need in a timely fashion. In particular, one of the things that came up was a piece of federal code. And we recognize that here in Oregon, we can't make changes in federal code, but we can urge our federal delegation to do so. And that's what SJM 4 does. The piece of federal code in particular we're talking about is 42 CFR Part 2, which essentially says that information about treatment for drug and alcohol addiction has to be treated differently from any other mental health or physical health information. And it needs to be treated in that way because historically, drug and alcohol addiction were stigmatized as being a moral failure rather than a medical illness. And we now know that the science clearly shows that drug and alcohol addiction are medical illnesses just as diabetes or high blood pressure are. And so it's important because many times when people have drug or alcohol addiction, they also need housing, they may need job retraining, they may need any one of a number of social supports. so that they can get the help they need to get back on their feet, to get sober, and to become self-sufficient, productive members of Oregon society. And so what SJM-4 does is it urges our, it asks our federal delegation to work on changing 42 CFR Part 2 to get rid of this provision so that we can go forward in how we treat people with drug and alcohol addiction and treat them with the respect and dignity they deserve, treat these problems as the medical illnesses that they are, and do the best that we can to get them back on their feet and engaging in society again. And I'll let Ms. Martin explain even more detail than I can, but I'll be happy to answer any other questions.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Pam Martin, and I'm the Director for Addictions and Mental Health Division at the Oregon Health Authority. And what I would add is that 42 CFR federal regulations were enacted in the 1970s, and they were most recently updated in 1986. A lot has happened since then in healthcare. One of the notable things is that in 1996, the HIPAA regulations were put in. So we have sort of a mashup of federal regulations around privacy for people. The other things that have happened since then are the development of an electronic health record for the exchange of patient data. Also, there has been a new focus on performance measures within the healthcare system, and more and more substance use treatment is taking place in primary care settings. For example, in Oregon, there are 80 physicians who are certified to prescribe buprenorphine, which is a medication that's used to help people cope with addictions to opioids. Some of the unintended consequences of 42 CFR include limiting the use of this health information for scientific research. Also, there's the senator said, it prevents the disclosure of information to provide coordinated care, and it limits the utility of the electronic health record. It's just hard. A lot of providers are finding it really difficult to figure out how to corral certain parts of information and not others. The Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration is, at the federal level, concerned about this as well. In June, they had an all-day listening session, and then they heard from people all across the country about problems that this is creating. They've asked the Legal Action Center to provide sample trainings and FAQs, because providers are having a lot of difficulty understanding how HIPAA interacts with this data information and how to go forward. And I do want to say, though, that there are legitimate concerns about privacy, about stigma, about risks of civil and criminal consequences. So we want to make sure that as we go forward, and hopefully some of these changes are made, that any updates to the regulations continue to provide confidentiality for people who are seeking treatment for their substance use disorders.
Has there been, have you talked to consumers about this?
We have talked to consumers, and I went to a large group of providers, and many providers feel that this would, it seems that the more people see the person as the whole person, as having physical healthcare needs, dental needs, social needs, when you look at it from that point of view, it becomes very clear that with consent, with full consent, that this is a better approach. It also, I believe, will help destigmatize some of these disorders over time if we treat them, as the senator said, just like any other disorders. This is a brain disorder, and something else is a pancreatic disorder. People who are only looking at the substance abuse and consequences in a more narrowly defined way, I don't think would be happy seeing regulation changes.
If I could add, Madam Chair, thank you. Putting on my physician hat for a moment, if we see a patient in our practice who is either in the throes of struggling with drug or alcohol addiction or is in recovery, we put that on their problem list just like they're dealing with type 2 diabetes, right? And because it affects their, like, I would like to know why their liver enzymes are up or why they have more of a risk for heart disease or why they might have, I have to screen them for hepatitis differently than I might somebody else. Because it's important for their preventive care. And as Ms. Martin said, to treat them as a whole person, because I'm not treating them properly as a whole person if I don't know all the things that could be affecting their health care. And if I know that, for example, they have a history of schizophrenia, I can put that in their health record and use that to treat, because we know that people with severe persistent mental illness are not getting the preventive services they need. And so if I can identify those patients in my population, we can reach out to them and make sure they're getting the preventive services. But if we can't pull information from our electronic health record about people with substance abuse, then we can't make sure that they're getting the right kinds of screenings that they need or the right kinds of preventive health treatments that they need. We have to treat them as entirely separate things. And it's as if, I can't even really articulate how odd it is to me as a physician, because I do see these people as being whole people, and I think my colleagues do as well. And it is, I will say, very rare at this point in time to have people who have drug and alcohol addiction issues and don't have other health issues, because we know that one of the problems is that these drug and alcohol addictions cause other health problems that have to be treated accordingly. And I treat high blood pressure or liver damage differently depending on what it's caused by. If it's caused by hepatitis C virus, it's different than if it's caused by alcohol use. And I've got to be providing the right treatment for my patients.
Questions? Okay, thank you. Cheryl Ramirez, Stacy Michelson, and Jonathan Eames. And then Alex Kohler will wrap it up.
Good afternoon, Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee. I am Cheryl Ramirez, Director of the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs. I'd echo the comments already made, but I did want to specifically state our support for this SJM-4. It's important for coordinated care for high utilizers of the mental health, criminal justice, and hospital systems, and it enables disclosure of health information needed for integrated care between physical and mental health providers, including consultation and referrals. I am encouraged by some national progress, namely the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, or SAMHSA's, strategic initiative to work with the Office of the National Coordinator for Health IT to develop technologies and standards to enable interoperable exchange of behavioral health data while supporting privacy, security, and confidentiality. This initiative specifically calls out revisions to 42 CFR Part 2 as one of the objectives for this year. And there's more legislative advocacy at the federal level, with a resolution supporting amending 42 CFR Part 2, which, by the way, was initiated by Lane County and was approved by the National Association of Counties on February 22nd as a legislative priority. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, I'm Stacy Michelson with the Association of Oregon Counties. I'm mostly going to echo Cheryl's comments. I'm just here to speak in support of SJM-4. As she mentioned, Lane County brought forward this issue to us, which we agreed to put forward to our national association, NACO, and they did just run this through their health steering committee, as Cheryl mentioned. So it's definitely an issue that we're feeling at the county level, that counties across Oregon felt enough passion around to go ahead and push this forward to our national association and seem to gain traction in that venue as well. So here to urge your support. Thanks.
Thank you.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jonathan Eames, and I'm here on behalf of Cascadia Behavioral Health and the Oregon Prevention Education and Recovery Association, which is the statewide association, it's easier to say OPRA, for alcohol and drug treatment facilities. And also, I just got a note from HealthShare as well to kind of say that they also support this bill. But so I think a lot of folks in our community or in the association really think of 42 CFR Part 2 as extremely important. not only do they represent the clients that they serve and the needs that they have, but also a lot of them have been in recovery for a long time. And so they personally have a feeling about protecting their information. And I actually heard about this issue about a year ago when I think the task force was meeting and there were a number of people who brought up this problem in that, you know, Oregon, we don't have to say it hundreds of times, is leading the nation on healthcare transformation and doing these wonderful things, and that this was a block to actually providing whole health and actually coordinating care. So when I first brought this up to our members, you know, the first reaction is, oh my gosh, we don't want to do anything to 42 CFR Part 2. But through a process of thinking about it and talking about it and meeting about it with individual stakeholders and being part of the CCO process, they have come to realize that while that is extremely important to protect this information, there are certain things you cannot do if you're trying to coordinate health across an entire system with various entities. That because of some of the blocks and when it was first introduced in 1975 or whenever it was, the intention was we're going to lock this down. We're going to make sure this does not get out because people were so scared about that information getting out. But now, if you look at the language in SJM-4, it really takes an effort to look at protecting and valuing that protection of information. And I think while we're all talking and the testimony that you've heard is about making sure that information can be shared, it actually is fairly nuanced in the way the resolution is crafted to say, no, we do value that. We do value protection of information, but where we can and where it will help the individual get better care on the balance, it is better to make sure that this information is shared in an appropriate way while protecting the information and protecting people's personal information. So, we very much support both Cascadia and OPRA, very much support this legislation. And there's other pieces of legislation this year. In fact, I was in a meeting with Senator Steiner Hayward right before the beginning of the legislative session, and when she introduced this and another concept, the first thing I said was, whoa, wait a second. But then when you dig deeper and you talk about it, you realize how important something like this is. So,
great. Questions? All right. Alex Kohler.
Good afternoon. Chairman Sanderson, members of the committee, I'm Alex Kohler. I'm Lane County's Intergovernmental Relations Manager. We're here in support of SJM-4. The issue came to us, if I might just tell the story quickly. We were involved with a project to assist a sobering center down in Lane County. And this is a not a detox center. This is where police have the ability to take somebody who's extremely inebriated, and we used to fund that program entirely through our own general fund, but over the course of the last several years we haven't been able to, and so we created sort of an ad hoc group that involved folks from the hospital, from the cities, and from the county to try to help fund it, because it's an efficient way of handling that those particular people and the ease to which public safety officers have access to it. One of the interesting things that came out of that work was that the chief of police in Eugene had identified 24 high utilizers of a public safety service. So these are people that, 24 people that the Eugene police had actually 485 encounters with during calendar year 2013. And what we were trying to figure out was, of those people, who were down at the sobering center. And we encountered this barrier of information sharing between those two agencies. And the sort of the workaround was that the police agency wasn't under any restriction to sharing those names, and the hospital and the sobering center were able to look at those and basically say, well, we recognize some of those names on the list. In fact, they recognized 22 of the 24. And the point was, here is this effort where we think there's real opportunity. In fact, we think the legislature has real opportunity to help us bring public safety and behavioral health services together in a more integrated fashion. And yet, their ability to share information and learn from each other is really pretty limited. So the police agencies are hamstrung by a lack of knowledge, essentially, of where the best place for some of these people really is. And that's why we ended up bringing forward this issue to the National Association of Counties. We knew that it had been talked about in the past. We find it remarkably close to the SJM, so we're in support of it. And I think one of the things, the conversations that Senator Steiner Hayward and I had early in the session when we realized sort of the similarities between what we were doing was, one of the things is there is a lack of sort of understanding of how, to what extent you can share information or how that can get accomplished in the absence of, for instance, a federal law change. And I think that's sort of another interesting opportunity is for how to, what is some guidance for these agencies to use around this so that they can, to the extent allowable by law, share information. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. You'll get the FSRIS. I didn't realize we needed to have a FSRIS on SJs. Okay.
Sorry, I would have.
I will close the public hearing on SJM 4. And, colleagues, I want to reopen the work session on Senate Bill 72 for the purpose of suspending the rules to allow Senator Steiner Hayward and Senator Knope to vote. Do you want to vote on it also?
I don't need to, but if you're opening it, I will.
Yeah, okay.
Madam Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of allowing Senators Steiner Hayward and Knope to vote on Senate Bill 72.
All right. So Senator Cruz moves to suspend the rules for the purpose of allowing Senator Steiner Hayward and Senators Knope to vote on Senate Bill 72. Is there any discussion? Is there any oppositions? So ordered. Senator Steiner Hayward, how do you vote?
Aye.
Senator Knope, how do you vote?
Aye.
Okay, you note that over there, and we will close the work session on Senate Bill 72. Did I close the public hearing on?
Yes.
Yeah, I did. Okay, with that.
You can adjourn if you want.
Colleagues, we adjourn. Okay, with that.
You can adjourn if you want.
Colleagues, we adjourn.